All right. Well, let's come back first thing to the report backs from yesterday's breakout sessions, and perhaps we'll take them in numerical order. So, Greg, would you be ready to lead off, please, for Group 1?
Thank you, Paul, and good morning, everyone. It was my pleasure to chair Group Number 1, and I'll do my best to report the group's conclusions. So the first question we were asked related to the distinction between application guidance and illustrative examples. In particular, did the group feel that the paper set out an appropriate and helpful way to distinguish between application guidance and illustrative examples? The paper describes generally how application guidance is necessary to apply the standard and has been subjected to full due process. In contrast, the illustrative examples are intended to help those applying the standard for the first time and may illustrate the mechanics of applying a standard and typically are not subject to the full due process. The group felt the paper presented a helpful and pragmatic way to distinguish between application guidance and illustrative examples. That said, the preparers in the group indicated that in practice, that the distinguishing between the two may not be so important. If illustrative examples or educational material help them to apply a standard, they will rely upon it. Even though it may be non-authoritative, it represents the best thinking on a particular topic. In other words, the group felt if it has IASB or Cannon Street on the letterhead, preparers will rely upon it. We struggled somewhat with the terminology or naming protocol, application guidance, and illustrative examples. Some felt that the term guidance could be read as meaning optional and that it may not be required to comply with it in all circumstances, and suggested it might be helpful to call it something else. Others noted that examples can be useful either in a standard itself or in educational material. In our discussion, we referred to the standard and the application guidance as being Part A, or authoritative, and the other non-authoritative materials as Part B. Someone suggested that the Part B information could be called supplemental materials. Someone else suggested, kind of tongue-in-cheek, that the board could come up with a contest, see if it could better name these two different areas of guidance. But in any event, the group felt that it was important to clearly identify the items as either authoritative or non-authoritative. The second area that we were asked to address went to risks with illustrative examples and education branding. In particular, question two asked, do the members support the publication of non-mandatory illustrative examples, which have traditionally accompanied most new standards as educational material? Yes, the group felt strongly that publication of illustrative examples was helpful. They are very helpful to preparers in implementing the standards. It was noted that there is a large demand for illustrative examples, especially and educational materials, especially in emerging markets. The group agreed, however, that the educational materials should not interpret the standards, but instead should illustrate their application. The third area that we were asked to address was post-publication support, and in particular the notion of establishing resource groups or ad hoc groups to share your experiences and help identify implementation issues with recently published standards. The group felt it was appropriate to create ad hoc resource groups, like what is being planned for revenue recognition, in order to identify implementation issues so that they can be referred to the appropriate group and addressed in a timely manner. Some noted that if the board does not undertake this, then others will, for example, industry groups or audit firms, and that it would be better to coordinate this activity under the IASB, where it will be more transparent. The group felt that the ad hoc groups should have representation from preparers, investors, and auditors. Also, that ad hoc groups could be established for other major new standards where appropriate. The final question we were asked, question four, went to, are there additional considerations or procedures beyond those described in the paper that the board should consider in relation to post-publication support for converged standards? And the paper talked about liaising with the FASB, where the board or the interpretations committee is considering modifying a new standard. And we felt that the paper adequately described the need for that activity, and we didn't really have any suggestions in that area beyond those that were described in the paper. So that's my summary of our breakout group, and I encourage any of my colleagues who were in the group to supplement or correct as necessary.
Thanks very much, Greg. Any supplemental comments from Group 1? Riaz.
Just one point. I think that was an excellent summary. I think one point we made was that the groups, such as the group being envisaged for the revenue recognition project, should have a limited life so that it doesn't become a self-perpetuating group. So because this is necessarily generally for the first part once the standard is released, but they must have a limited life.
Thanks, Riaz. Any other additional comments? Excellent summary. All right, well, let's turn next to Andrew, Group 2.
Thanks, Paul. For our feedback, I'll first give a little bit of context because we had some discussion on the current structure of the accounting standards. We then largely dealt with questions 1 and 2 together. So we looked initially at the question of whether there is in fact any distinction at all in material issued by the ISB, and many group members felt that in reality anything that comes from number 30 Cannon Street is regarded as having more authority than guidance issued by another organization. So that puts it in a separate bucket to start with. Looking at the more recent standards, a number of members of the group indicated that they do find the structure of current IFRSs in some respects a little bit confusing, although they recognized the way that things are being split out was intended to be helpful in being able to find things in particular places. However, they did note that standards currently contain some guidance which is authoritative and some which is not, and that combination was felt to be a little bit unhelpful. Group members also commented that they didn't really like the need to look in multiple places in a standard for guidance, and many felt that it would be better for all authoritative guidance to be in the same part of the document. So that would perhaps be returning to the way that standards were structured a couple of years ago. However, it was considered appropriate to make a distinction between application guidance and illustrative examples along the lines suggested in question one. But it was felt that the distinction would need to be very clear for any material that had not gone through full due process. And so any educational material would need to be, for numerical items, purely mechanical, or for disclosures, be illustrative with clear signposting that this was just an example of what the disclosures might look like. And this links to the current project to amend IS-1, which has a view of eliminating excess disclosures. We weren't in favor of a box-ticking exercise being created, and there's always a risk of that without some very clear guidance. It was also felt that it was appropriate for the ISB to have badged the IS-13 guidance on valuing unlisted equity instruments as educational material. That was very helpful. What that meant was that there would be two building blocks. Standard itself would contain all the information and guidance. The education material would be published separately, and that could then be published at the same time as the standard, or supplemental information could be published later. Any guidance, though, that illustrated judgments, such as what constitutes a significant deterioration in credit quality of financial assets measured at amortized cost, would need to be part of the accounting standards. That should not be educational guidance. At this point, a number of members of the group wondered whether educational material was quite the right name, as in some respects it suggests interpretation, and perhaps a different name, maybe practical examples and guidance, would be one way to do it, and then you can see whether staff have got the pegs completed. There was then some discussion about whether the inclusion of all of the application guidance examples in the standard would result in bright lines in the interpretation. It was felt that the risk of this outcome could be mitigated by emphasizing that the examples are just a guide and to state specifically that they're not setting out any bright line thresholds. Another point raised was whether, if a preparer had a particular fact pattern that matched an application guidance in the example in the standard, but there were some additional facts, was there a risk that those facts might give a different answer, so they might either be ignored or fail to be brought into account? The group felt that any changes, any additional facts would in practice be brought into account with a potentially different accounting answer, so that's not a significant risk. One other concern, and this was from the user side, was whether preparers might end up including so much information in financial statements that it would become difficult to understand the picture that was being conveyed. One of the preparers did say that it was necessary to have a compromise between clarity and clutter. There needed to be a certain amount of information. And in reality, if something wasn't in the accounting standard, then they might go searching in accounting publications for the answer instead. That was the feedback from questions 1 and 2. Moving to question 3, the group was very supportive of the formation of a group to look at the revenue standard and also a similar approach being taken for other major projects. It was noted that the revenue group would not be issuing any guidance itself, and this was felt to be of critical importance, that any issues identified that needed to be dealt with would need to be passed up to the ISB or to the Interpretations Committee. And without this approach, there were some current concerns that views expressed about issues discussed at the revenue group could become de facto IFRS, which would be undesirable. Some members of the group were also concerned about the potential for the US rather detailed and IFRS more principles-based approaches, ultimately resulting in different guidance being issued by the ISB and the FASB. And similarly, given the US desire to have only one accounting answer to each issue, was there a risk that US membership of the group might suggest that only one of two potential acceptable approaches was appropriate? And if that happened, what should the ISB do? We felt really this was something that is very difficult to legislate against and was probably something that needed to be lived with. However, to guard against this, it was suggested that the revenue group and any other joint groups formed would need to have very clear terms of reference, including that decisions about issues would not be dealt with and would instead be passed on to the standard setters. And there would need to be an oversight mechanism to ensure that this was followed in practice. Coming back again to the IFRS-US divide, there was then the question of the risk that the EITF, because it takes on rather narrow issues, might decide to address an issue that the Interpretations Committee decides not to. Excuse me. And in the event that there was this uneven approach, it was suggested that the Interpretations Committee and EITF should, in those circumstances, revisit the issue. Ultimately, if there was a difference in approach, that difference would just have to be lived with. However, one thing that the ISB should do in those circumstances would be to make it clear that there wouldn't be any requirement for an entity following IFRS to follow any more detailed guidance that the US had issued. Moving to question 4, we had a general discussion of this one. It was felt that the approach to be followed would depend very much on the standard involved. A more detailed approach would be needed for major projects such as financial instruments and insurance. One point raised was, though, that if these groups are formed and there are quite a few issues that are raised for the board and the interpretations to deal with, it would be necessary to have some care to ensure that other projects were not subject to delay because of these issues being dealt with. One other point we discussed briefly was the question of the liaison with IOSCO. This was felt to be very welcome, but it was suggested that the ISB might consider whether there are other organizations that they could meet either separately, or perhaps it might be efficient to meet them together with IOSCO discussing emerging issues. One point that was raised just at the end was that if IOSCO is involved in some way in the standard setting process, even in identifying issues, there might be a governance issue because of IOSCO's membership of the monitoring board. That might be mitigated if all that was being done was to identify issues for the ISB and the Interpretations Committee to consider, but it might be worth addressing that in advance. I'd welcome any input or comments from other members of the group. If I apologize if I've missed anything. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Any supplemental comments from Group 2? Andrew, if I understood you correctly, with respect to question 3, I think you made the point that should the FASB issue more detailed guidance, it wouldn't be necessary to comply with that in order, if on a converged standard, in order to comply with IFRS. But presumably the hierarchy would allow that but not require it. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, that was very much the point, that it would be perfectly open for an entity to go with the more detailed US guidance, but there would be no requirement to do so.
But hopefully that scenario would be hypothetical and not real.
We felt
the eternal optimist. Don't. I don't think I'm going to bet my family fortune on that one.
We did hope that the boards would do as much as they could to avoid it, but it was always a risk sitting in the darkness.
Any other questions or comments on Andrew's report? Well, thank you for that, and we'll turn to Group 3, Françoise.
Thank you, Paul, and good morning, everyone. In fact, I'm very impressed when I listen to the summaries of the other groups because they seem to have reached conclusions. And in our group, as an excuse for a possible bad summary, in fact, we agreed that the question raised did not find any easy answer. So for some reason, we didn't come to any conclusions or comments on question 1. Question 2 starting being debated right away. However, in the course of the discussion, it became clear that participants were rather comfortable with the descriptions proposed, because in fact we used them in the discussion. So everyone agreed that the authoritative part of the standard should stand by itself, and that this may well be in fact the only thing that was clear to everyone. As a result, the more robust the application guidance, the least one is tempted to look at illustrative examples as supplementary guidance. In other words, if you increase the quality of the application guidance, you remove possible tension created by the illustrative examples. Then, depending on the perspective that we adopted in the discussion, I mean, we explored a wide variety of possible answers, and ranging from, and frankly, I'm not exaggerating, from bringing the illustrative examples into the mandatory section of the standard to entrusting educational material to an external party. So we really, I think, contemplated a wide range of solutions. And in fact, every time something was contemplated, it came from putting some particular argument forward. So we started from the fact that the IFRS, whatever the IFRS Foundation issues as some form of authoritative status, and in fact the other groups have also stated so. So if you want the illustrative examples to carry, you do not want illustrative examples to carry any, you have to have them dealt with separately, but separately completely. And this is thinking on this path that we wondered whether the educational material should be entrusted to an external party. The solution, however, did not have many supporters because they raised the issue of the selection of the trustworthy party able to serve the public interest. So if everything the IFRS Foundation issues has some form of authoritative status, why should we bother separating application guidance from illustrative examples. That is when we considered whether illustrative examples should be merged into application guidance. However, consensus seemed to arise that illustrative examples, if issued authoritatively, would be overly prescriptive and create issues from an enforcement or legal perspective. They would also serve as platform for a rules-based set of standards. So we supported illustrative examples as being helpful in becoming familiar with the standard. Therefore, we thought, as discussed in the agenda paper, that they should be available at the same time as the standard is published. This called for the illustrative examples to remain within the IFRS Foundation remit. The IFRS Foundation remit raised the question, who should be responsible for drafting those examples? The ISB, as eventually the case today. However, we had two ISB members with us in the room, and they were not totally aligned as to whether the board was invited to vote as part of the balloting process on the illustrative examples, or if the illustrative examples were more something aside. So maybe that could be clarified. Or whether the responsibility would vary from being entrusted to some ISB members to staff only, as this is described currently in the due process handbook for educational materials. So for some of us, whether the ISB or the interpretation committee is in charge carries more weight than when it is left to the staff. For others, in fact, as soon as you have the IFRS Foundation logo somewhere, it has this kind of authority. But we also seem to agree that if those illustrative examples should carry some form of authority, that means illustrating possible outcomes, they are better supported by appropriate due process. We also agreed that the perception of authoritative status brings also confidence in the material provided. So it's not only necessarily a bad side of things, it's also some comfort that if you happen to be in line, basically, you kind of safe. But of course, you don't want to be obliged to. Then we considered whether we would be comfortable with no illustrative examples being available as part of the ISB consultation process. And at that point, some consensus seemed to arise again that illustrative examples were very helpful in understanding what the outcomes of the standards may be. And this seemed to lead to the conclusion that the process leading to the preparation of the illustrative examples should not be changed from what it is today. So as we were eventually progressively accepting the status quo, that is not to support that the illustrative examples are integrated in the IFRS Foundation Education Initiative, we discussed whether having the illustrative examples on the website only instead of in printed form would contribute to change the perception everyone had of them. We thought it would not change the perception. However, the idea of having illustrative examples be supplemented, updated at a later date at some appeal, and this supported the idea that they would be available on the website. We did not discuss the process that should be followed for those supplements. And instead, we moved into question three. Efforts to ease implementation of new standards continue to be supported in principle as a useful tool to achieve consistency in application. Such an effort, though, is valuable only when major changes are introduced. We also discussed very shortly the revenue recognition group, but because that was discussed at the council meeting the other day and the group support to it, we didn't concentrate on this particular group but dealt with the issue more generically. So we felt that these, so while there is support for this implementation effort, strong support, we felt that the, putting them in place raised governance and due process issues that are eventually further reaching than is eventually anticipated right now. Everyone seems comfortable with the idea that ad hoc implementation groups do no more than defining the follow-up action to request received, if any, and that is, they have decisions to make, to do nothing, to suggest educational material, to ask interpretation or a limited amendment to the standard. And it was suggested that requests received and actions defined, so these actions defined, should be published on the ISB website in addition to the audio recordings. We discussed all this on the assumption that such a group would operate from publication date until the effective date of the standard. Some participants felt that the implementation group would best support existing industry groups in providing confirmation that requirements and how they should apply the standard have been well understood. This would suggest that the ISB encourages people to start implementation efforts right after the standard is published. Others felt that people might refrain from starting implementation efforts in case changes would be made to the application guidance, that such a process would increase, not decrease, uncertainty. So on this basis, some discussion took place as to whether post-publication efforts should not be turned into pre-publication efforts. So there were arguments in favor of pre-publication efforts and also drawbacks. So the arguments in favor were that this particular step in the ISB due process would move the ISB end of process outreach efforts and final impact assessment in the public arena. That is, ensure that all constituents are treated on equal footing in that process, and it would not necessarily require more time than what is devoted today. The second argument in favor were that changes to be made would not require any special supplementary due process. They would remain part of the final deliberation. The third argument in favor was that the overall quality of the final product would be improved. It may help prepare more robust guidance and illustrative examples that do nothing more than illustrating. However, such a process would not be without difficulty. It could be perceived as supplementary consultation, something that the ISB would want to avoid and then should certainly avoid. Even though the ISB due process would make clear that there is no room left for supplementary discussions, it might not be so easy to dismiss political pressure put into the process. It would be difficult to contain the time necessary for the whole process, and implementation efforts may not start as people would not have the comfort of a finalized set. And the last comment made was that it was 4:30 and time to come back to the room.
Thank you very much, Francois. Any supplemental comments from groups three? Ken Hong.
Thanks, Chairman. Please allow me to make my brief personal view within 2 minutes. I prepared this last night. When I first made presentation at IFRS-related seminar, probably in 2007 in China, I tried to tell similarities between principles-based SPI rule and principles-based IFRS before my scheduled presentation. One of the similarities I said was that there can be different interpretations based on people's understandings. We all agree that Bible cannot be rewritten. IFRS, however, can be changed and should be changed if necessary for the consistent application worldwide. I admit that location of AGs and IEs is up to the decision of ISB. In my view, same merits that both AGs and IEs have, that those examples and guidances can help the user to have higher level understanding of IFRS. Only difference between them is that AGs are titled to decision made by ISB, and IEs and BCs are not. This is my suggestion. If the board members of ISB put more time and energy to screen IEs and BCs, you can help millions of accounting people worldwide from their struggle to understand IFRS and can save them from their possible misuse of IFRS. Thank you.
Thank you, Chen Hong. I'm sure we would all vote for more involvement of ISB members in your spare time. Not to dismiss your point, it just does have some very significant resource implications. Any other supplemental comments from the group or questions of Francois? Francois, I think I heard you say that after a lot of differences of views on question two, you have eventually landed on leaving the process as is. Did I understand that correctly?
That's what I said, and I couldn't emphasize more on the word eventually, because I'm not...
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut off your comment, but... All right, then no more questions. Let's move to the fourth group. April, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In group four, I had a very charming group of gentlemen, preparers, users, regulators, and auditors. And despite that mix, there was strong consensus. We started off with a discussion emphasizing that it's important that the ISB not overstate a problem or make it more complex than it needs to be. So along with the other groups, we agree that all material that comes out of 30 Cannon Street carries some form of authority, but there can be distinguishing levels of authority. The issue is not when someone gives something more authority and follows an example, perhaps a little too religiously than they should. That's their prerogative. The issue is when something does have the highest level of authority in Part A in the standard and someone wishes to deviate from it. So we all agreed that examples, whether they be in Part A or illustrative examples or labels, no matter how, were very important and were to be encouraged. But examples mustn't be interpretive unless they're in Part A or come from through due process from IFRIC or from the board. The distinction on authority is to be achieved through clear health warnings. So we moved into the sort of the packaging aspect fairly early on and believe that the clear use of health warnings, much like on a cigarette package, and the careful use of wording around examples and indeed inside examples, as both Alan and Michael referred to yesterday, was a critical aspect. We didn't think it was important whether they be in various coloured books on the website or not on the website. We felt that those types of constraints wouldn't make a clear enough distinction, but that if an example was meant to be interpretive and say, here is how you do this, and that was had been through due process and was in Part A, which is labelled, this is the standard, then that was sufficient. If it was for just an example and can be done maybe this way, other options are available, along with appropriate health warnings on the bottom of each of those pages or in boxes with those health warnings, would be critical. The process that is followed, due process or not, is a critical part in determining the authority and examples are to be encouraged. They are important that they don't interpret or close down options. The material that was developed that was going to be illustrative examples or education material that staff and the reviewers identified had interpretation in them was appropriately dealt with and sent off to follow through due process and be treated appropriately. Regarding the packaging, as I mentioned, we didn't think it was critical, whether it was one book, two books, three books, or whether it was coloured. It's a consistent, clear health warning and use of the words. I won't say any more on that. Oops, sorry. With regards to the development in question three of public discussion groups, etc., group four held somewhat of a different view from what I've heard from the other groups' summaries so far. It was felt that the IASB cannot field the world's questions, and that it is an important role for the national standard setters to provide assistance when a standard is being applied in their jurisdiction, a new standard is being applied, and to organically bubble up the questions that need further attention at a global level. So Group 4 did not support the development of a discussion or implementation group. And they felt that IFRIC was the critical route for interpretations and that national standard setters or staff could provide other examples and education material that were not interpretive. They felt it was particularly critical to avoid creating any new mechanisms. They felt that there were sufficient existing ones to address the problem. If needed, if there was felt that a new standard was going to create significant questions and discussion around implementation, that there might be a need to, on a temporary basis, increase the resource available to IFRIC in dealing with interpretations, etc. So the group went as far as to recommend that the mandate for the revenue recognition group be changed, and that as a minimum, at least it be taken out of the public arena, and that any discussions that were held more in private as a stepping stone for material to be sent to IFRIC or onto the education group or to be dealt with as staff papers or back indeed to the board. They concluded this because they felt there were significant risks around the fact that such a group would want and would want to produce material, in fact would need papers, etc., developed for it, and there would be significant confusion around the authority of those documents coming out of yet a new structure and mechanism. It felt that such a group could add benefit to serving or supporting IFRIC or the education initiatives and to do the types of things that was being described to do, but not as a new formal mechanism in the public domain. Then finally on question four, on we talked about the converged or joint standards. We felt that each body, whether it be, let's say, the FASB or the IASB, could produce examples through education material or through staff papers or through illustrative examples, as long as they were examples and did not venture on into interpretation. Interpretation must be joint, in the opinion of the group. So felt it was necessary to define the long-term relationship between the boards, particularly with regards to the relationship between IFRIC and the EITF, and felt that should be a formally binding relationship, a binding agreement between the counterparties, such that on joint and converged standards that interpretations would be issued jointly, but that examples that were just that, examples, and didn't have an interpretive element could be issued by either party without reference, but obviously with communication, but without that could be issued separately. It was very interesting at that point we had a discussion about cheating spouses and the need for long-term binding contracts, but I won't go into that point. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure perhaps the gentlemen in my group might like to add their views on what I've summarised here.
Thank you, April. Any supplemental comments from Group 4? Any questions of April? Christoph.
April, about this contract arrangement between the ITF and IFRIC, has the group discussed that historically the two bodies have a different focus, with EITF looking into things that are significantly more narrow than what the Interpretations Committee is looking into? And I wonder how such a contract we do things together would look like if historically the groups have a different focus. So if EITF wanted to go for a very narrow topic that usually the Interpretations Committee would not accept, would that contract force the Interpretations Committee to accept that this is done jointly, although it would contradict the historical scope of what the committee does?
Others on the committee may, the group may wish to comment, who have more experience than myself, but I understood from the discussion yesterday that for joint and converged projects, then both parties, much like the IASB and the FASB have demonstrated, would need to reach some compromise on such matters, Christoph. So occasionally I suspect the IFRIC might have to agree to look at a narrower aspect, and to a certain extent the EITF for joint projects might have to resist the urge to be quite as narrow. But there was a strong feeling that it needed to be a binding agreement, that for joint projects, matters of interpretation needed to be joint. So I guess there'd need to be, again, those compromise approaches. But perhaps the group who had more thoughts on that?
Well, first I'm going to turn to Mark, had his card up.
Yeah, I was part of the discussion, and I would agree with April's answer to that. I think you would have to look at where the compromise is. That's the idea, and probably both have to give some way. And perhaps you have to deviate then from the agenda criteria that you would normally apply in IFRIC for the converged standards in order to accommodate that. But I personally think that it is unrealistic to expect that if the EITF would go and do very detailed guidance, that would not become somehow find its way into the IFRS system. And so therefore, I'd rather have, you know, the two bodies working together rather than say, well, let them go on their own way.
Thanks, Mark. Joel?
Just a very quick addition to that. You know, I think that in retrospect, we probably should have been thinking about, in the MOU initially, acknowledging the fact that there are differences in how interpretations are done between the two, on either side of the pond. But I would hope that maybe in good faith the two parties would, in effect, create their own post-nuptial agreements to carry on the allegory of marriage.
Well, I think the important point is I sense a very strong view that converged standards must remain converged, and to achieve that, that applies to all the authoritative material, absolutely the interpretation. And this is not news. There was, going back, 10 years or more ago, there was a joint meeting in Toronto, FASB, ISB, and the Canadian Board, and one of the major topics on that agenda was the importance of reaching agreement on the interpretation of converged standards, and so that marker has been down for a long time. Now, we're not going to get into engineering any particular part of it.
No, it's only that our group had a view that was slightly different from what you just said, So we saw that there is a limit and that rule-based guidance may be too high a price to pay for convergence, and that there must be a limit defined where the ISB say that's getting too far into the rule-based way, so we step out here. So not that it needs to be converged, and finally if the price to pay is rule-based, then let's go for rule-based, maintain converged. That was not the view in our group.
Okay, maybe I misspoke. First of all, I think it's very unfair to categorize everything that comes out of the U.S. as being rule-based. That's overstepping the mark, in my judgment. But I think what we're saying is if you put all the time and effort into developing a converged standard, the boards ought to reach agreement and understanding as to how post-issuance the interaction of the boards, including interpretations, whatever that answer might be, the user community collectively would benefit from understanding that so that we can at least monitor it, decide whether you agree with it or not. But is that a better way of reflecting it, that there ought to be an understanding, formalized, whatever that means, but at least a like mind of the goal, aspirational perhaps? But sorry if I overreacted to that. And I'm not a fan of the EITF, but any other? There are some very interesting comments. Jim?
Thank you, Paul. I was in Francoise's group, and Francoise, congratulations. I think we had 12 people in the group, and we had 14 opinions on most of the questions that were being raised. But I would like to just make a couple of observations around the review groups that were discussed, because our group had a lot of debate about the time. I think we agreed they should have a finite life, but we had a lot of debate about what period that finite life should be. Is it up until the effective date of a standard, or is it some period shortly after? I don't think we had a single view, although we had a lot of strongly held individual views as to what that period should be. But I would like to just observe that Andrew, in his group's report, if I got the words right, sort of was supporting the review group's existence and observed, as we agreed, that they should not be decision makers, but that any issues identified needed to be passed up to the IASB. I think some in our group, and perhaps me particularly, are very nervous about the idea that that review group can somehow make decisions about what should be passed up to the board. They are not an arbiter of making a cut of decisions as to what is important and what is not important. And I will tell you this from experience that I have had recently dealing with IOSCO in my own world, where we had a group similar to the review group who received a report from IOSCO on IOSCO's concerns about one of our auditing standards. And that group made some judgmental decisions about what was key and what should be passed up to the board for discussion. Later, we discovered that IOSCO's strongly held view, although not expressed in the meeting, that everything we say is important, and everything that we say needs to be heard directly by the board. So the idea that whoever is communicating with this review group might find that their comments are somehow tilted before the board hears them is a challenge. So we think that a clarification of exactly what the review group's mandate needs to be and whether they are gatherers of everything, collators of everything, and providers of all that information to the board is much more important than that they might be considered to be somehow a filter of the information received.
And that's an important point. I had assumed all other channels remain open. So the fact that this particular group might not bring an issue forward does not preclude someone else from bringing it forward. But if that's not understood, or if I'm wrong, that point needs to be clarified. Andrew, is that?
Yes, thank you, Paul. Just a couple of points in response. In relation to the implementation groups, there would be issues that the review group would feel it would pass on or send to the interpretations committee of the ISB. I suspect that one bit of due process that would be helpful would be that, I'm sorry, let me move it toward me. Is that a bit better? Okay, right, I'll start again. On the review groups, and the question of what might be sent to the Interpretations Committee or the ISB are not sent anywhere. It's perhaps something to consider a little bit of internal due process at the board, so that it's not just that review group's decision that someone else has got eyes on it. Now, whether that's something for the Interpretations Committee to look at and consider whether the views reached are appropriate, it would filter it and it would help take the decision away from the review group, because I do see that there's a danger that someone raises an issue, it goes to the review group, and it disappears into nothing. And that might not be entirely satisfactory.
Everybody seems to be talking about review groups, but review implicates that you're going to look at the standard and review it, and that's not the idea. It's a resource group.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Pretty unclear.
It's perhaps a terminology. I'm not looking at it in terms of any change to the standard. It is in terms of are there issues that need to be dealt with, not any narrative change at all. The other point might be in relation to the timing of any work that might be done on the new standards. Typically, the ISB and the Interpretations Committee have not done terribly much until the actual implementation dates of standards. We're in a position at the moment where, certainly for these new standards, it'll be a period of years before they will become effective on a mandatory basis. And there's also experience with some more recently issued standards that indicates that perhaps a little bit of a review back where there are issues raised in the early days of implementation would be quite useful.
And I thought Francois did a good job of laying out the pros and cons on the timing issue. I was going to try and hazard a few generalizations based on the report back. I mean, this is tough territory, I think, would be way of summing it. From what I heard, I sensed that people accept that the greater good is served by providing some supporting information. Labeling is important to clearly distinguish what has the authority and has resulted from due process and other things that are done to great care, but not the same due process. And that distinction is key critical. Where the material is placed and how it's presented should be driven by more practical considerations, I think, would be the way, you know, what's considered to be most helpful, most retrievable. Timing is a consideration. So I sensed overall support for trying to respond to some of these requests, but on the other hand, you can't answer every question or you will end up being in a very rules-based type of situation. So I take it overall as cautious, urging caution, but being supportive of the direction that you're headed in on the, I'm not sure what I'm going to call these things now, implementation, resource, transition, whatever. Admittedly, Group 4 reached a different view. My sense was the other three were saying not necessarily for every standard, but that there could be circumstances where such groups can play a useful role. Timing, I think, needs to be considered, whether part of that role is perhaps while the standard's being formulated or before it becomes effective. That's an important consideration. I think there was support for the need for due process governance around it. Due process is the wrong word. I think governance oversight to ensure the groups are properly populated so that you have a range of perspectives, which is always a challenge if you're trying to do it globally and keep it to a manageable size. But I did sense the concern that there be broad perspective. Again, I think Group 4 was the outlier, really arguing for a private, behind-the-scenes, more like a staff resource I thought the others were arguing actually for the opposite, transparency. So I think that needs to be considered, and a shelf life. And I think that was a point. It may have only been raised by one group, but I would just pause here. I would think that would have general support, that there's a need on a regular basis to consider whether it's past its useful point in time or not. Beyond that, I sense, you know, some mixed views, and it's probably the sort of thing you want to reflect on in terms of the way you go forward. Oh, and finally, on the converged standards, I think a strong desire that, to the best of our collective abilities, that to keep the goal of a converged standard, we need, as best we can, keep the authoritative interpretive literature similarly converged, and that perhaps something like an MOU or something that's a little more visible to the world at large would give comfort to them and perhaps support to you as it plays out. That doesn't do justice to the conversation, but does that capture main points? By all means.
Well, I found this a very useful discussion, even though the conclusions were not very clear. I must say, the conclusions are not clear to me either. And this is something that is very difficult for the board. On the one hand, you need very strict rules of due process. On the other hand, they are very strict, and there is little flexibility compared to I think a big advantage of the situation in the United States is when you have unclarity and which needs a quick resolution. Sometimes the SEC can just step in. We don't have that in our system. Not the ideal solution, of course, but sometimes it can, like in the question of the novation of derivatives, was a very quick solution in the United States. So it took us, even though we took a very short period for a due process, it took us quite a bit of time. I think the board wants to give this resource group on revenue a chance to see how it works. I'm also nervous about it, mm-hmm. Because you can see how much effort it costs us to get the standard done, and I'm really worried that in these conversations new issues will come up, and perhaps we should make a small change to the to the standard even before it comes into effect, and that it becomes a continuous process of standard setting. At a certain point, you have to set the standard and accept that there, perhaps in the beginning, there may be a little bit of divergence in practice, fix it at a later date, but you have to stabilize the system at a certain point. And I'm really worried that this is going to lead to an unstable situation. So we really have to try to avoid this. Given the fact that our due process is so strict, we do need some flexibility, for example, through the illustrative examples where we can help the market out without going through all the motions. I think I generally heard support for that. So that is important. That is important to know. Then where you put it, I think, is a secondary question. But I think I heard around the table that there is support that we need some, for the fact that we do need some flexibility.
That was helpful. I'm just going to offer a gift to you and to you. I can imagine there'll be considerable enthusiasm and pressure to say, wonderful idea, let's create another one here, another one there. Sorting the need and the mandates of these groups is a challenge in its own right. And perhaps it's a role that the council can play, you know, at an earlier stage in a project. We, you know, might be worth reflecting on whether people see a need, you know, a significant circumstance around a particular project that might warrant some additional measure, so that it becomes the exception rather than the norm, and you're not being petitioned to constantly create these things. And I think that's an offer I would make to the board, to say I think the council would be quite willing to explore on a preliminary basis, you know, whether they thought such a group was warranted, what its mandate might usefully be. And likewise, I would make that suggestion for council members to consider going forward, because maybe one of the instances where we will learn through experience, try it very carefully, sparingly on one or two, and then have a very thoughtful consideration as to the pro. And I thought one of the presentations laid out there are advantages and there are risks to this. Francoise.
Sorry to ask for the floor at the time the conclusions are made, but I was wondering whether this could not be a subject for having a working group of the advisory council and bringing, helping further.
Happy to take that on board, and even happier to pass it on to someone else. But yeah, good suggestion. We will add it to our list of potential agenda items and see if there might be interest in putting a working group together, Francois. All right. Well, that is a very tough topic, mixed signals. But I think there are times when the mixed signals are what you need to hear, that caution is needed.